Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, or afternoon, I guess. The only case we have this afternoon is Camelot Banquet Rooms versus United States Small Business Administration and Ms. Dixon.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, Courtney Dixon for the Small Business Administration. The district court's preliminary injunction cannot be reconciled with the Supreme Court's opinion in Regan and the other selective subsidy cases. As this panel recognized in granting a stay pending appeal, Congress has not restricted or regulated plaintiff speech. It has merely—
Counsel, if you want to keep your voice up, that's not an amplifier, just—
I'll speak louder. This is my first in-person argument back, so I'll have to get the kinks out. Congress has not restricted or regulated plaintiff's speech. It has merely decided not to subsidize it out of taxpayer dollars. That decision is subject to only rational basis review, and it was rational for Congress to decide that it was not the best use of taxpayer dollars to subsidize businesses such as plaintiffs at this time, particularly in light of the fact that businesses such as plaintiffs are associated with well-known and widely recognized secondary effects.
Ms. Dixon, hello, it's Judge Rovner.
Hi, Judge.
The amicus, and to a certain extent, the plaintiffs argue that this is an unconstitutional condition on the grant. Can you distinguish Agency for International Development versus Alliance for Open Society International for us?
Certainly, Your Honor. In the USAID case, the Supreme Court there distinguished between Congress, you know, setting forth the terms on which it will offer a subsidy, and then an unconstitutional condition where Congress has leveraged its funding to regulate speech outside the contours of the program. So in USAID, Congress had not simply selected the entities that it was going to fund, but it had leveraged its funding condition and established an ongoing condition on grant recipients that they were to adopt the government's message, in that case, to eradicate prostitution. Here, Congress is not seeking to leverage any funding to regulate speech outside the contours of the Paycheck Protection Program. Congress has simply stated that it's not going to subsidize certain specified categories of businesses. And the Second Circuit in the Farrow's decision held that the Paycheck Protection Program didn't seek to leverage funding within the meaning of the unconstitutional conditions cases. And the DC Circuit reached the same conclusion in the American Association for Political Consultants case. This is not an unconstitutional condition, again, as both of those courts had held.
To follow up.
Agency for International Development quoted Legal Services Corporation versus Velazquez, and for the proposition that Congress can't recast a condition on funding as a mere definition of its program in every case, lest the First Amendment be reduced to a simple semantic exercise. So what is your best argument that Congress did not try to skirt the First Amendment problem with this condition by simply recasting it as a definition of its program?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I mean, the Supreme Court has stated that not every condition on funding can be or cast as such, but it's also the case that it cannot be the case that every time Congress has stated we're not going to subsidize these types of businesses, that that's an unconstitutional condition. And I think that that's the upshot of plaintiff's argument here. Congress has merely stated, you know, these businesses are not eligible for Paycheck Protection Program funds, and that's the end of the matter. Congress isn't seeking to kind of do this backdoor regulation of speech that the court was concerned with in the USAID case, or the FCC versus League of Women's Voter case is also the kind of canonical unconstitutional condition. There, if you accepted even 1% of government funds, you were prohibited from editorializing, even using your own private funds. So that was the same circumstance in which the program was seeking to leverage funding to regulate speech in a way that the in a way that Congress couldn't do directly. They couldn't do it by imposing a condition on funding. But that's simply not the circumstance we have here. Again, Congress has set forth numerous categories of businesses that are simply ineligible for Paycheck Protection Program funds. That choice is subject to the least rigorous form of scrutiny. And as I noted earlier, it's certainly rational for Congress to decide that it's not the best use of taxpayer dollars to fund businesses such as plaintiffs, just as Congress decided that it was not the best use of taxpayer dollars to fund political consulting and lobbying groups at this time. And of course, the DC Circuit upheld that prohibition in the American Association of Political Consultants case, and the Second Circuit has upheld Congress's prohibition on providing Paycheck Protection Program funds with respect to first draw loans to businesses such as plaintiffs. So to the extent that the district court applied a more rigorous form of scrutiny, that's not consistent with the Supreme Court subsidy cases, and yet this is simply not an unconstitutional condition.
Mr. Dixon, to follow up on the constitutional condition question, do you think, for example, Congress could say we're going to exclude plaintiffs and similar businesses from the Social Security program?
Right. With the Paycheck Protection Program in particular, this is akin to the subsidy at issue in Reagan. Congress is providing a benefit that, in much the same way as the tax deduction there, is similar, functions similar to a cash grant. And with respect to this kind of generous congressional largesse, the Supreme Court has been clear that Congress has wide latitude to decide who and who is not eligible. Again, the D.C. Circuit noted.
So, what about the Social Security program?
The Social Security is, in some ways, also a government benefits program. I don't know the ins and outs of Social Security to maybe give the court a square answer as to whether it's akin to a subsidy in the same way that this program is. But there's no doubt that, again, this is in many ways akin to a cash subsidy. Paycheck Protection Program loans are they're special government-backed loans that no collateral or guarantee authority is required. They're eligible for forgiveness up to the full principal amount borrowed. And as the D.C. Circuit, again, in the American Association of Political Consultants case and the Farrow's decision in the Second Circuit both noted that this is squarely in line with the Reagan selective subsidy cases.
Could I, as I understand the way the statutory exception works, it would also include what we might call adult bookstores, right? And we don't have plaintiffs who would fit into that category, but it does seem to me that if you're trying to distinguish between adult bookstores and kind of general purpose independent bookstores that are small enough to qualify for the program, that would certainly tend to look a lot like content-based discrimination.
Well, the Supreme Court has stated that, Congress can make content-based distinctions when it's deciding whether to provide a government subsidy. I think, Congress can't go further and engage in invidious viewpoint discrimination, but there's no suggestion of that here. Congress has defined a category of speech, purient speech that is explicitly intended to be erotic, whether that's in form of lie erotic dancing or adult bookstores, adult shops. That's a category of speech. And so Congress can legislate with respect to that category. And as this panel recognized in granting a stay, the First Amendment jurisprudence in the Supreme Court's cases all support the idea that purient sexual material is a category of speech.
The plaintiffs have contended that they're willing to modify their business practices to meet the standards of the PPP if only they could determine what the standards actually are. How do you respond to this vagueness argument, given that the SBA is not using the Supreme Court's definition of prurience and obscenity? How is a business to know what conduct will exclude it from programs for aid? And for that matter, how does the CBA ensure consistency in the decisions?
So at the time that the SBA promulgated the regulation that Congress incorporated into this statute, that was back in 1996, Congress listed in the statute an establishment that features nude dancing as an example of a business that would fall within this prohibition on live performances of a pure and sexual nature. So to the extent plaintiffs are businesses that, you know, present dancing that is nude or nearly nude, that falls within kind of the heartland of the regulation. With respect to their, you know, unconstitutional vagueness argument, one, again, they fall within the scope of the regulation, and so if you fall within the scope of the regulation, mounting a vagueness challenge, the court has said you can't do that. But in any event, we're talking about a grant program, and again, not a restriction or regulation on speech. And the Finley case, the Supreme Court made clear that within the context of a grant program, vagueness concerns are far lessened. And in that case, the court upheld a condition on grant funding that required the consideration of decency and respect. And with respect to your honors question as well, the SBA offered in this case to conduct a review of any plaintiffs who believe that they were wrongfully excluded based on this regulation, and none of plaintiffs took SBA up on the offer to have their eligibility reviewed under the regulation.
Can you possibly explain that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Have you any idea of the reasoning behind that?
Behind plaintiffs not taking up? I don't.
That decision.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm happy to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal unless the court has further questions.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brad Schaefer appearing on behalf of the plaintiffs. Since Judge Rovner and Judge Hamilton killed my best leads, I'll go on to something else.
You could go on to why you didn't take advantage.
Sure,
of the
sure, Your Honor. I'm an Eagle Scout. I'm really big into truth. I've been litigating these cases my entire career. There's going to be a time when I'm going to have an opportunity to get discovery from Mr. Benderson or someone else. I see what happens when you lay out ahead of time what your arguments are and what it is you're trying to accomplish by way of your depositions in order to... I'm sorry, I'm looking down at the screen here. I don't know where to look, but I know how these cases go, and whatever we argue, they're going to argue something else. I'm entitled to have a deposition that is an honest deposition that I get candid answers from. And given the fact of what has gone on, where the SBA has argued in the D. Horton case that they acknowledged it was vague, where they try to argue in my DV Diamond Club case, Your Honor, that it meant erotic, to which I said that makes it overbroad, to which Judge Lightman said to the SBA, yes, that would make it overbroad, and then they backtracked.
Yeah, but forgive me, but could you just answer my question?
Yes, Your Honor. We don't have to undergo an unconstitutional standard, a standardless, completely discretionary process, which, by the way, Your Honor, by the way, and we pointed this out in our briefing, they've never, even if you look at Mr. Benderson's declaration, they've never looked at the entertainment. They make these decisions on their own, based upon the name of the company, based upon a website that they may see. And if you look at all the websites of all the plaintiffs, nobody's naked, nobody's topless. They're making these decisions on their own. We do not have to undergo that type of, to get an ad hoc, arbitrary, capricious decision, Your Honor.
So you're saying you're finished before you begin?
Your Honor, most of my clients already were. We had three categories of clients. We had clients who were denied, where the SBA made decisions, already made decisions. You're precluded. We had ones that were being held pending a decision, and we had some who could not even literally get an application in because the banks were saying, because of this permanent sexual nature regulation, you don't pass go, you don't collect $200, you can't even start. Litigating a case on a...
Are you contending that the SBA was violating the First Amendment for the last 25 years by applying Section 120, 110 to exclude prurient businesses from other loans? Is there any meaningful difference?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
Apologize.
Is there any meaningful difference between what the SBA has done on general loans in the past and what is happening with the Paycheck Protection Program loans?
Everything in the world, Your Honor. Because SBA loans, as we pointed out in our brief, Section 7A, those are the general SBA loans, they are always discretionary. I have a good friend who's on the local board. They're always discretionary. That is not what happened under the Paycheck Protection Program. If you are the correct size, and for round two, if you had the need, you had to have a reduction of your revenues year to year during the 2 years of the pandemic of 20 or 25%, I don't remember what it was. If you met that, you were entitled to the standards. So litigating a case in a preliminary injunction basis can be interesting because things can happen while the case is developing. And so at 9:41 this morning, I get an email from Matt Howitt. He is an AUSA in my Restaurant Revitalization Fund program that is pending out in Pennsylvania. And this is, I'm just going to share with the court the first paragraph, and this directly involves some of the clients here. Gentlemen, first, here's some very good news for your clients. I understand that the five RRF applications were approved and are set to pay today or tomorrow. These payments will go to bank accounts on the RRF applications. So you and your clients will want to be on a lookout for those electronic payments. If there are any issues with these payments, please let us know. These are clients that had been denied funding under the RRF under the same regulation that we're dealing with here. Yet in that lawsuit, the SBA decided, you know what? It's not going to apply that. Why is that relevant here? Well, it's really relevant for two reasons. First is the RRF amounts of money you can get are offset by PPP money. My five clients are now getting millions of dollars under the RRF. Four of my clients who are plaintiffs here are now getting millions of dollars under the RRF and don't need this lawsuit anymore because it's set off money and will be withdrawing their case. Now, that's not all my plaintiffs. That's not all my plaintiffs, but that's four of my plaintiffs here. Now, why is it that four of my plaintiffs can get millions of dollars under the RRF that originally had the exact same regulation, and now they get their millions of dollars, and my other clients, they don't get anything because they didn't file RRF applications, they just filed for PPP. And RRF is grant money, not loans, not forgivable loans. It's grant money. My clients get that. And those clients are all getting that now. Now, what I had intended to lead on was International Agency Development, or Agency of International Development, which Judge Rovner beat me to the punch. However, I did want to expand on that a little bit. Chief Justice Roberts goes through great lengths to describe the difference between what is a governmental program and what is a governmental subsidy. He talks about Reagan. He talks about Leathers. He talks about Arkansas Writers Project. And if you read his analysis of those decisions, the distinction is extremely clear. He talks about the fact that while government may be able to make content distinctions based upon the program, you are not allowed to make content-based distinctions based upon the recipients. And what he talks about, specifically in regard to Reagan, that Ms. Dixon talked about, was the fact that, as Chief Justice Roberts pointed out, It was easy, extremely easy, I think was the actual language the Chief Justice used, for the businesses at issue there to separate out 501c3 actions that were based on lobbying efforts, which they couldn't get money for, as opposed to everything else that they could. All right. And because they could participate in the program, that was a constitutional, that was constitutional. Contrast that to Arkansas Writers Project versus Ragland. Chief Justice Roberts points out that if the business used even 1% of federal funds in that program, the exception did not apply. The tax exception, the tax deduction did not apply. That, the Supreme Court ruled, was unconstitutional. There is nothing, save for what Judge Rovner was talking about, there is nothing save for my clients just not engaging in any type of expression for fear that they would be determined to be of a prurient sexual nature. There is nothing we can do in order to participate in this program.
I would like you to comment, please, on something that we said in our decision on the motion for stay pending appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it would seem, okay, that you have not distinguished between government suppression of protected activity and the denial of a subsidy. Your theory, certainly in the briefs, seems to be that the denial of a subsidy is itself the act of suppression. And we need to really delve into that, if you would.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the reason that it is infringement, I won't use the word suppression. The First Amendment talks about infringement. The reason that is an infringement is because of exactly what the Supreme Court has said time and time again constitutes infringement. Let's take a look at various examples in the case law that has been cited to this court. Iancu and Tam, all that was a trademark. That business could continue to go on, could continue to operate, could continue to use the repulsive trademark name. And the Supreme Court said that that in and of itself is infringement. If you look at the tax cases, again, Your Honor, Arkansas Writers Project versus Ragland is only one of them. But if you take a look at the tax cases, all you're talking about is not having a deduction. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court, time and time again, has said that that is a violation of the First Amendment. I also wanted to make a comment, Your Honor, and this is not a Seventh Circuit case that I cited in my brief, because if you look at my word count, I was about three words short. But in this court's decision in Etzel versus City of Chai, this court has noted that there is no rational basis level of scrutiny under the First Amendment. When you say that, all you are saying is the First Amendment doesn't apply to the analysis. But the First Amendment clearly here does apply to the analysis. In fact, in regard to Section 633E, where we talk about Congress specifically said, not just a determination of obscenity, we want a court. We want a court of law utilizing the current constitutional standards in order to determine whether the SBA cannot fund. Now, in their reply brief, the government makes the lesser greater argument. If you can regulate the greater, you can regulate the lesser. Well, first of all, the Supreme Court negated the lesser versus greater in 44 Liquor Mart versus State of Rhode Island when it overruled Posadas. But more importantly, that doesn't address the question of Congress saying, we want courts of law to make this decision. We do not want an SBA administrator looking at a website or the name of a business in determining that loans will not be given out at all.
You know, the Supreme Court seems to treat prurience as a type of content rather than a viewpoint. I'm referring, of course, to RAV versus City of St. Paul.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your best argument that prurience represents a viewpoint rather than a category of speech or a type
of
content?
First of all, let me address, because I didn't have the pages to do this, let me address your citation to your case. I apologize if I'm destroying the name of this case, Kosharik. I did not address that specifically in the brief. I did address RAV. Kosharik is irrelevant for the exact same reason that RAV is, and all you have to do is look at the last paragraph of this court's decision, where it talks about what we are talking about here is obscene material, and this court said, which is not protected by the First Amendment. Therefore, if you want a subset of that, if you want to only exclude the worst of that, which is what Wisconsin did in the Kosharik case, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that's okay. That's not a violation of law because it's all illegal. Now, Your Honor, the best argument, and I've got very little time, but the best argument clearly is 30 years ago, when I wrote my briefing to this court on Miller versus Civil City of South Bend in the second and third appeals, I talked about what is the expression at issue in nude and topless dancing. I talked about the ideas. I talked about the communication. And Your Honor, en banc, this court accepted exactly what I said and talked about ideas over and over again. You don't have to have even viewpoint discrimination. As we know from what the Supreme Court says in Leathers versus Medlock, all you have to have is discrimination of ideas. This court in the en banc decision, Miller, uses the word ideas probably 10 times. 10 times in describing my client's expression in that case. But more importantly, in getting directly to your question, Your Honor, Iancu and Tam, I did not come up with the definition of lewd and lascivious. The SBA did. That has definitions in it. That's part of the patent offensiveness prong of the Miller test of obscenity. That's not even part of the prurient appeal prong. That's the patent offensiveness prong. And what Iancu and Tam clearly say is giving offense is a viewpoint, Your Honor. That is not Brad Schaefer on constitutional law. That's Chief Justice Roberts on constitutional law.
Counsel, your time's expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I'll give you another minute if you have anything you want to...
Unless there are other questions.
I don't think so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just to respond to the last part of that about Iancu and Tam. In that case, the court held that the trademark registration is distinguished based on viewpoint. With respect to the Iancu case, you could have a message about, for example, religion if it wasn't going to offend members of that religion, but you couldn't have a message about religion if it would be offensive. So again, and that's viewpoint discrimination. That's simply not an issue here. Across the First Amendment jurisprudence, purience is described as a category of speech as this court recognized in its stay panel opinion. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court might have. Otherwise, we've set out our arguments in our briefing and think that the stay panel decision cogently understood.
It's just sort of a general question for you, Ms. Dixon. How does excluding prurient businesses from loans further Congress's goal of supporting small businesses during the pandemic?
Well, with respect to the Paycheck Protection Program, it obviously made available a substantial amount of money to aid small businesses at this time, but taxpayer dollars are nonetheless limited, and Congress had to make policy judgments and trade-offs in deciding which businesses to fund. That's a quintessential legislative choice, and it was rational that Congress could decide that because businesses such as plaintiffs are associated with secondary effects, that it might not be the best use of taxpayer dollars to fund them with second draw paycheck protection program loans. And the Supreme Court made that point in Regan, that in deciding in a government subsidy program, Congress is the political body that's best positioned to decide whether the money spent subsidizing a business is, quote, worth it. And here, Congress could have, again, rationally decided that, was not the case. And to the district court's point that somehow Congress has singled out plaintiffs' businesses, as we've explained, that's simply not true. There are numerous categories of businesses that are not eligible for these loans.
Of the other businesses, say, lobbying businesses, the ones that have been excluded, have there been any other such cases, to your knowledge, brought?
Certainly, to my knowledge, of course, there's a D.C. Circuit case which upheld the prohibition on political consulting and lobbying groups. I'm aware of a decision that's, I believe, in the district court in the Sixth Circuit that involved passive businesses. I'm sure that there are other businesses and exclusions, but those are the ones that I'm aware of, other than the strip club cases. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I apologize, Your Honor. You were going to give me another minute. I didn't take it. There was a procedural matter that I wanted to bring up that I completely forgot about. Could I please just address that for 30 seconds?
All right. Then I'll give counsel another minute to, after you respond. You can come and do that now. You take a break now, and then you can come back and respond.
I apologize.
Skip my mind. Not permitted, obviously, to say what happened at mediation. However, this court's first stay order ordered the SBA to keep the set-aside monies. The second stay order that this panel issued does not have that language in there. I don't know if that was intentional or not. I intend to take this up if you rule against us, and there is no ability to get damages. My clients will be completely without a remedy. And so all I'm asking, Your Honor, is whatever decision you come out, if you could just order them to maintain the set-aside funds until I have sufficient time to get in front of the Supreme Court, that would be great. I apologize again for not raising that earlier.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have another minute in addition.
Thank you. I mean, I don't have anything additional other to say the SBA has set aside funds for plaintiffs. We did that in the district court, and of course we stated in our stay papers that we were able to continue to set aside the guarantee authority. So
I'm sorry, I did not hear the last part of your response.
Oh, sorry. As we stated in our stay papers, we have continued to set aside the guarantee authority.
So you would have no objection to modifying orders as Mr. Schaefer suggests?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.